From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hello to you. I'm Ira Melman.
Hi, Ira. I'm Jim Stevenson.
Hi, Jim.
On the program today, the United States and China have announced new plans to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That's the highlight of a summit between the country's top leaders.
President Barack Obama has left China. He has now arrived in Myanmar, also known as Burma, where regional leaders have opened the annual summit meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. We have the latest for you.
We'll be looking forward to the American Cafe, where Ashley Westerman takes us on a tour of the Appalachian region of the United States and how some of its residents are dealing with new and changing health care coverage.
And we have the latest world sports news, as well as our musical segment today dealing with the best paid female singers.
All coming up on VOA Global. You found Daybreak Asia. Good morning. Come on in. A summary of Asian news and events for Thursday, November 13th. I'm Jim Stevenson. In brief today, China and the United States have jointly announced what they're calling a major agreement on climate change. The agreement was reached following talks in Beijing between U.S. President Barack Obama and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. The two also pledged to work together in a wide range of areas, but there are differences between the two countries which still loom large. VOA's Bill Ide is in Beijing and joins us with more.
At a joint news conference following high-level talks in Beijing, Washington announced plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions by up to 28% by 2025. That goal, if reached, would bring U.S. emissions to levels below those in 2005. China did not commit to cut emissions, but for the first time, Beijing set a goal for its emissions to peak by 2030. President Barack Obama says it is an ambitious but achievable goal for the world's two biggest emitters of greenhouse gases.
I commend President Xi, his team, and the Chinese government for the commitment they are making to slow, peak, and then reverse the course of China's carbon emissions.
China and the United States hope the announcement will help to overcome long-standing differences in global climate change negotiations and be a shot of momentum ahead of next year's United Nations Climate Change Conference in Paris. President Xi says China is willing to work together with other countries to address global changes. President Xi says that as China continues to develop, we will shoulder more and more international responsibilities that match our strengths and position. The agreement on climate change was just one of several announced. Chinese President Xi Jinping says the two countries also will leverage their strengths to fight Ebola, although some have criticized the speed of China's initial aid response in the fight against the deadly disease. Mr. Xi noted that China now has more than 300 medical workers in West Africa and has donated more than 100 million to the effort. They also agreed to work together to fight other infectious diseases and to promote access to electricity across Africa. President Obama says they also talked about enhancing cooperation in Afghanistan and in dealing with terrorist threats such as the Islamic State. President Xi highlighted an agreement the two had reached between their militaries for confidence-building measures that include notification of major military activities and rules of behavior for safety of military aircraft and encounters at sea. Before President Obama's three-day visit to China, it was not expected that the trip would deliver such a wide range of agreements. But the major differences between the two nations remain. From concerns about China's human rights policies, its policies in ethnic minority areas, and tightening controls on foreign journalists. Bill Ide, VOA News, Beijing.
From Beijing, we move to the 25th summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, which is now underway. Steve Herman, our VOA correspondent in the region, is reporting from Myanmar's capital, Naypyidaw, that the summit opened with the host's expressions of concern about unfulfilled goals.
The ASEAN summit opened with the anthem of the organization, an unfamiliar song to which few of the leaders and Southeast Asian diplomats in attendance could sing along. That reflects the current dilemma of ASEAN's 10 members. Some 48 years after its formation, the organization is still trying to define its goals and agree on harmonious policies for a diverse community of more than 600 million people. The summit's host, Myanmar's president, made note of this in his opening speech. Thein Sein cautioned that 1 year before the launch of the ASEAN Economic Community, which is supposed to create a single market, challenges remain in implementing the remaining 20% of the targets and addressing the issues that will emerge in the post-2015 ASEAN community. The president also stated ASEAN needs to play a greater role in the international arena by taking a more united stand in addressing issues of common concern and interest. That was interpreted in part as referencing the frustration among some states with the slow pace of finalizing a code of conduct for the South China Sea. The Philippines and Vietnam, in particular, have raised strong concern about maritime standoffs in the disputed waters involving Chinese vessels. The ASEAN meeting will be followed Thursday by the 9th East Asia Summit. U.S. President Barack Obama is to attend the summit, along with such other leaders as China's premier, South Korea's president, and the prime ministers of Australia, India, Japan, and Russia. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the ASEAN Summit in Naypyidaw, Myanmar.
We go back to China now. As you may know, November 11th is Singles Day. It's a big holiday and a big time to spend money. Well, that Chinese holiday has now brought in record sales again for Wednesday, with millions of buyers flocking to e-commerce site Alibaba and other stores to take advantage of special sales. Shannon Van Sant in Beijing opens up the cash register to see how much they took in.
It started in the 1990s as a way for single people in China to celebrate being single, the opposite of Valentine's Day. Since then, the holiday has transformed into a celebration of consumerism, with stores and e-commerce sites offering huge sales. Luo Ray is a 30-year-old shopper in Beijing.
I think that the original idea is to try and get people who are single and a little bit bored at home in this cold weather in November to start shopping online. But then it's spread out. It's spread out to everybody because the deals are too good.
Alibaba, China's largest e-commerce site, said today it had racked up more than $9 billion in sales. That beats Alibaba's previous record of $5.9 billion. For comparison, American shoppers spent just $1.2 billion during last year's Black Friday. Another online store called JD.com said sales in the first 10 hours of Singles Day were 2.4 times last year's volume. And many smaller and mid-sized retailers say up to 15 to 20% of their annual revenue comes from sales on this one day of the year. Luo says many buyers like her will stock up on items for their homes.
Normally just small stuff like a blender, like things, home appliances. Like you can buy anything now. Like I'm thinking about changing my curtain in my room, like back home. He can do that.
The explosion of consumer spending comes at a time when China's economy is slowing. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
I'm Jim Stevenson. It was fun being with you today. Daybreak Asia comes to you every weekday on VOA Global, and you can subscribe to it as a podcast for free at voanews.com.
Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman on VOA Global from the Voice of America. We're in Washington, and we want to hear from you wherever you might be. We want your feedback, and that's what this segment is all about, Jim.
It's real easy for you to write to us. You can join us on Facebook, Twitter, Weibo, and at voaasia@voanews.com. That's our email address. We had a few stories that people had commented on, but first we want to talk about the poll that we have out between China and Japan relations.
Here's the question. What do you think the APEC summit meetings will do to improve U.S.-China and China-Japan relations?
Well, 20% so far have said that this will prompt long-term positive change. 45% say that it's just not going to fix anything. 30% say there's a potential for positive relations, but we'll have to wait and see. And about 5% of you so far are unsure.
Who are the people who are unsure on these things?
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. We're part of the 5%. Please vote on our polls. And how do they vote on the polls?
They can go to our website at voanews.com. Join us on Facebook as well. I think it's out there on a few other places, too.
I do believe so. On the story of Veterans Day in America, a listener on Weibo said he read our story, had watched a lot of video of history lessons on YouTube to learn about the history of World War I. He didn't learn about the history until after he had left school, and he felt history education in Chinese schools is inadequate.
Well, I'm glad we were able to help him out there. During Obama's visit to the APEC summit in Beijing, he gave a speech to let China know the U.S.'s goodwill towards them and announced that the United States would be extending visas for Chinese nationals.
Sona Mia said on Facebook, love that name, that there are good news about that. And Zirimal Hotak said on Facebook, it's going to be a useful visit for Obama.
Write to us, VOA Asia at voanews.com. This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. Jim Stevenson, along with Ira Melman. Coming up?
Coming up, you have an author segment dealing with a book that is now out. Apparently, some new information has come out concerning the time between China and the Soviet Union and
That's
the relationship.
Right. New archives of memos and letters between all sorts of government officials have shed new light on the history between those two nations.
That's coming up. And also, a story on the green...
I'm Jim Stevenson with Authors on Asia. We open the book today with Austin Jurseld, Associate Professor of History at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. He wrote the book, The Sino-Soviet Alliance and International History. There was a tense period between the former Soviet Union and China, which began with the 1950 Treaty of Friendship, Alliance, and Mutual Assistance, which obviously did not live up to that treaty's positive name. As Moscow sought to build a strong communist ally in the Soviet bloc's Cold War struggle against the United States, Russian imperialism rose to become a wedge that would alienate China, frustrate bloc member nations, and eventually collapse the Soviet Union. Jurseld tells me how recently opened Russian and Chinese archives are revealing intricate details of mutual frustrations seen in a wide variety of source material.
I've enjoyed the study of international relations and diplomatic history, but I feel that it's too often done by scholars in the West with attention to traditional sources and traditional matters, high-level diplomacy, memoirs, national security-related documents. And so much more is out there in the study of international relations, in the study of foreign policy, in the study of international history. There are so many different kinds of sources and kinds of materials, whether you're talking about film festivals and newspapers and university student exchange. And there are just all sorts of different kinds of sources that can really be fruitful for the study of international relations.
That must really provide some amazing insights for researchers and scholars, having the availability to a lot of these archives now and gaining a picture of the relationships that we didn't have before.
This kind of work is so exciting. As you say, I mean, there are new opportunities here, new sources. And in the old days, we were just sort of dependent on Pravda, Izvestia, and Renmin Nerbao, the People's Daily in China, or Pravda in the Soviet Union. These were important sources. And, of course, you can learn a lot from reading those sources and from reading newspapers generally. And people did. We did. But nothing beats being able to combine that sort of knowledge with more exposure to the archives.
At the risk of oversimplifying it, it would seem that the Soviets had wanted to at least make China somewhat in their own image. But did they underestimate the Chinese?
There was an ongoing problem there that was evident in some of the terms that eventually the other bloc parties, and the Chinese in particular, used to describe the Soviets. They talked about great power, chauvinism, or even kind of traditional Russian chauvinistic attitudes that were evident among the advisors themselves, who maybe looked at China in a kind of condescending way as a traditional sort of Eastern and backward land that they were trying to enlighten and kind of culturally improve. So all this was very insulting to the Chinese, and they began to talk about these things openly. They began to communicate with the other bloc parties about these things as well, very openly. The Poles and Czechs and East Germans and others in the bloc had concerns as well about the Soviet Union. There's a lot lot more interesting material that allows us to kind of see these internal debates.
We do like to learn from history to try to get a sense of where things might go in the future. How would you categorize the state of Sino-Russian relations at this point? And is it a matter of what the Russians can learn from the Chinese now?
That is an interesting transformation here. You know, what can the Russians learn from the Chinese? That's an interesting question. They can learn a lot, obviously, like we all can. But the problem is, I think, from the Russian perspective, that there is still remains a kind of disbelief that an Eastern society could be so much more productive and better off than them. That history, I think, is difficult for Russia to overcome when now, as you say, the relationship has been reversed. And if anything, it was more for Russia to learn from China than there is for China to learn from Russia.
Austin Jurcell, Associate Professor of History at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. His book, The Sino-Soviet Alliance and International History, is published by the University of North Carolina Press. I'm Jim Stevenson. I'll put our bookshelves back in order until next Thursday, when you may hear more Authors on Asia on VOA Global or anytime by visiting the voanews.com website.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. The United States and China Wednesday announced new plans to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. The announcement by the world's two top emitters of carbon dioxide could play a key role in global efforts to combat climate change. U.S. President Barack Obama says his country agreed to cut emissions by 26% to 28% by the year 2025. That is double the pace of current pollution reduction efforts. Chinese President Xi Jinping said his country's CO2 emissions would peak by 2030. It is the first time China, the world's top polluter, has committed to such a date. He also said clean energy sources, such as solar and wind, will account for 20% of China's energy production by the year 2030. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez is traveling with President Obama. I asked him whether the announcement came as a surprise.
Sarah, this was very much for most of the world a very surprising development, a major development. I would say it was the crown jewel of the visit for Mr. Obama, who was frankly expecting a very difficult visit in Beijing. But what officials told us on the plane leaving Beijing was that this agreement had been in the works actually for several months. They said the deal was complete well before the president arrived in the Chinese capital. There were some small details that were worked out on the margins. President Obama and President Xi spent some time on the plan on Tuesday night, and then came the announcement.
What did President Xi say about this particular agreement? Because I know there's been some discussion as whether China is as willing to try to reduce emissions as the U.S. is.
See, what makes this a remarkable agreement is that China was always seen as certainly a rising power, a rising industrial power that frankly could not afford to jeopardize its development by enacting strict environmental controls. That has been the view in China for many years. President Obama went to Beijing with this message to the Chinese. If you want to be a world power, you need to act like a world power. That means taking responsibility and taking a leadership role. So here is your chance. Join Washington in this, and, well, this will put you on your way to being a responsible partner, something that will benefit everyone in the region and will benefit the world. That's how it was played to the Chinese, and that is certainly how Mr. Xi sought to portray his decision, saying, well, it's going to be in the benefit of China to get its environmental act together, if you will. While the issue of climate change is not one that, you know, is on the minds of most Chinese people, it is safe to say that most Chinese people are concerned about pollution. That is something that they live with every day, and where they want to see improvement, Mr. Xi's decision, the government's decision to make this announcement, is along the lines of addressing that concern.
And what about some of the more contentious subjects between the two leaders, such as the human rights and the current protests in Hong Kong and cybersecurity?
You know, the way U.S. officials have portrayed the visit, it was it accentuated the positive. And at the press conference on Wednesday in Beijing, well, both sides spoke quite frankly about the issue of human rights. Especially surprising was President Xi, who was very, very direct when the question of the Hong Kong protests came up. Of course, his government has in the past few weeks, in a very subtle way, accused the United States of being behind those protests, of somehow influencing the demonstrators to come out and challenge the Beijing government, something that, well, the United States says it is not doing. And she very pointedly said that the demonstrations and the situation in Hong Kong, the electoral process in Hong Kong, is an internal Chinese matter to be settled by the Beijing government, in essence telling the United States not to get involved.
VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez. Earlier this week, the U.S. and China also reached a breakthrough that could lead to fewer tariffs on high-tech products. They also announced a deal to extend the lengths of visas granted to U.S. and Chinese citizens. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
This is VOA Global from the Voice of America with Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. Let's check what happened to the markets and business news from Asia. China shares finished at a three-year high Wednesday, led by gains in brokerage stocks, while the Taiwanese market fell on expectations that a China-South Korea free trade agreement could pressure that island's exporters. Benchmark for Shanghai Composite Index ended with a 1% gain, the highest close since November 15th of 2011. That was buoyed by expectations that a stock trading link between Shanghai and Hong Kong will launch Monday. Well, investors in Hong Kong also showed their enthusiasm ahead of the trading program's launch. Hang Seng Index was up 0.6%, a third straight day of gains. Monday launch date of the Shanghai-Hong Kong Connect program was announced on Monday. However, that free trade agreement between China and South Korea that was announced Monday had Taiwanese stocks closing lower, and Korea's benchmark, KOSPI, gained 0.2%.
Well, those watching the dollar found it higher against the yen in Asia trading Wednesday, with jittery investors sitting on the sidelines ahead of a decision by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe as early as next week on whether to delay a planned rise in the sales tax.
It is true that few Americans had heard of the manufactured anti-Valentine's Day holiday in China called Singles Day until this week, but that hasn't stopped U.S. companies from raking in a portion of its sales. While Chinese brands benefited the most from the anti-love holiday invented by Alibaba in 2009, Germany's Adidas and Beaverton, Oregon-based Nike were the two top brands, and Alibaba's sports apparel category by gross merchandise volume, that according to preliminary company data.
That's Asia Business News on VOA Global with Ira Melman. I'm Jim Stevenson.
This is Today in History. On November 13th, 354, Augustine of Hippo, Algerian bishop and theologian, was born. Augustine is considered one of the most important figures in the history of the Christian Church. On this day in 1850, Scottish novelist, essayist, and poet Robert Louis Stevenson was born. In 1956, the U.S. Supreme Court declared racial segregation laws in the southern U.S. state of Alabama to be unconstitutional. In 1970, a tidal wave and storm surge caused by a cyclone killed over 200,000 people in East Pakistan, now known as Bangladesh. In 1971, the U.S. Mariner 9 unmanned spacecraft became the first man-made object to orbit another planet, sending back clear pictures of the Martian surface. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Well, during the Asia Business News, Jim, you heard about the story about Alibaba and that Singles Day that they had, bringing in $9 billion the other day.
That's incredible.
Unbelievable. Later on in the program, stay with us, because we're going to have a story about Alibaba and what it has done in the overall stock and investing world. It's unbelievable. Wait till you hear about it.
It's amazing, because Alibaba really doesn't sell anything itself. It just... is a conduit for sales. And wow, do they really facilitate a lot of movement of cash and goods.
Yeah, and it keeps on growing. You remember Facebook, you remember some of the other social media sites that they started very strongly and then they kind of reduced. Well, the same is not happening for Alibaba. Wait until you hear the numbers about this.
Let's catch up on the latest world news. It's coming up next with International Edition and Steve Norman.
And now, VOA's International Edition. Coming up, ASEAN Summit getting underway in Myanmar. We'll have the latest on the Ebola outbreak, plus tensions in eastern Ukraine. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. World and regional leaders are in Myanmar's capital for the ASEAN Summit. Among issues they're looking at are the Ebola crisis, the rise of the Islamic State militants and pressing regional matters, including South China Sea tensions and the situation on the Korean Peninsula. Leaders attending include the U.S. President Barack Obama, China's Prime Minister Lee Kyi-chung, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, South Korean President Park Geun-hye, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is there, and Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev. Before arriving in Myanmar, President Obama took part in the APEC summit in Beijing, where he and Chinese President Xi Jinping put aside differences with a deal on cutting carbon emissions. Jake Schmidt is the director of the International Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council here in Washington.
These are the two biggest emitters in the world. They've been historically the major stumbling block to climate action at the international level. And for these two countries to come forward and say, yes, we are going to continue to act, and yes, we are going to take deep cuts for the post-2020 timeframe is huge.
Under the agreement, the United States will double the pace of carbon emissions reduction by 26% to 28% below the 2005 levels over the next decade. China, whose emissions are still growing as it builds new coal plants, committed for the first time to a self-imposed deadline of 2030 to stop the growth. Both sides hope the deal will spur similar action by other nations ahead of a global summit on climate change in Paris next year. And meantime, President Obama's opponents in Congress are concerned about the pledge dismissing the new U.S. target as job-destroying red tape that will squeeze the middle class. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who is positioned to take over as Majority Leader once the new Congress is sworn in January, spoke Wednesday with reporters.
I was particularly distressed by the deal apparently he's reached with the Chinese on his current trip, which, as I read the agreement, requires the Chinese to do nothing at all for 16 years, while these carbon emission regulations are creating havoc in my state and other states around the country.
White House says the deal reached with China can be achieved under existing laws and would not require congressional action. But some observers say Republican lawmakers could try to roll back some of the regulations already in place, making implementation more difficult. NATO says it has observed fresh columns of Russian tanks, artillery, and combat troops entering eastern Ukraine. NATO's supreme commander is U.S. Air Force General Philip Breedlove.
So what I recently reported was between 250 to 300 inside Ukraine, and those are special forces, trainers, people who are helping the Russian-backed forces in eastern Ukraine to assimilate all of the weaponry and the sophisticated capabilities that Russia is moving into the Russian-backed forces. Now, we do not have insight into what has happened these past several days because these convoys and these movements, the white trucks, the heavy equipment are coming in, and we don't have a clear picture. My guess is that those numbers have risen, but I think it's safe to continue to report that there are at least 250 to 300 advisors in enabling, training, and equipping the Russian-backed forces in eastern Ukraine.
Russia immediately denied the allegations. A Russian defense ministry spokesman dismissed Breedlove's comments. Moscow has repeatedly denied any official military involvement in Ukraine and has described the Russian troops fighting alongside the rebels as volunteers. Syrian activists say 7 weeks of U.S.-led airstrikes have killed at least 860 people in Syria, most of them Islamic State militants. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said Wednesday the actual number could be much higher and includes at least 50 civilians. The U.S. and a coalition of other nations began hitting Islamic State targets in Syria in late September, expanding an air campaign against the group in Iraq, where the militants had seized large parts of the country's north and west. A tally of statistics released by the U.S. Central Command shows coalition planes have carried out 350 airstrikes in Syria, another 450 in Iraq. Mali has confirmed its second case of Ebola after a healthcare worker in Bamako died on Tuesday. Katerina Hoya has our report.
More than 90 people were quarantined across the Mali capital on Wednesday after a 25-year-old male nurse died of Ebola, having treated a Guinea man, a Muslim imam from the border town of Kuremale, who died from Ebola-like symptoms that were not recognized at the time of his death. Health workers immediately began monitoring dozens of family members and medical staff. They also searched Bamako for those who helped bury the corpse, not knowing the body was still highly contagious. Mali is the sixth West African nation to report Ebola during the world's worst ever outbreak of the disease. The country must now map a new group of contacts to this recent case. The initial group, linked to the death of a two-year-old girl who succumbed to the virus last month, were just released from their 21-day quarantine on Tuesday. Health authorities confirmed Mali's second Ebola case had no connection to the two-year-old victim who had displayed symptoms while traveling through the country by bus, including Bamako, on her return from neighboring Guinea. The areas quarantined in Bamako include the Clinique Pasteur, where the latest victim worked, the mosque where the imam's body was washed, and the houses where the nurse lived and the imam stayed. Concern is growing over the time it took between the death of the imam and the steps needed to contain the deadly disease being put in place. Mali shares an 800-kilometer border with Guinea, which alongside Liberia and Sierra Leone have been the worst affected by an Ebola outbreak that has killed nearly 5,000 people this year. Katrina Hoye for VOA News in Bamako.
Researchers have developed a single-dose, needle-free Ebola vaccine that has protected monkeys against infection for more than 4 months. Vaccine is administered through the nose, protecting the primates via the respiratory tract. One key advantage, according to researcher Maria Croyle at the University of Texas at Austin, is that the vaccine could potentially prevent transmission of the virus from being unintentionally stuck with a needle when someone is cleaning up unsafely medical waste. European Space Agency has landed a robotic probe, that's what it is, on a speeding comet half a billion kilometers away, just around the corner. Mission was considered risky due to the potentially unsafe surface circumstance. And in fact, some media are reporting now that there are difficulties with that. We will keep you updated as you stay with us here at voanews.com. In fact, if you want more news, there's plenty there. Our website again, voanews.com.
This is VOA Global. Jim Stevenson along with Ira Melman as we check business news. U.S. stocks ended Wednesday's session essentially unchanged as the main indexes struggled to stay in record territory. The S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average snapped a five-day record closing streak. The S&P 500 closed lower at 2038 as utilities and energy sector stocks sold off. The Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped 2.7 points. The NASDAQ Composite defied the trend, and it closed higher, adding almost 15 points to close at 46.75.
Google's YouTube is rolling out the long-awaited paid monthly subscription service called YouTube Music Key. The subscription for the ad-free service will start at just under $8 per month, and it's going to allow you to watch videos offline and listen to music while the other apps are working.
Well, what do Facebook, Chevron, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Walmart, Procter & Gamble, General Electric all have in common?
Pray tell.
It's not a bad joke. All are among the 25 largest companies in the S&P 500, and all are currently smaller than Alibaba Group Holding Limited. The Wall Street Journal reports when Alibaba went public less than 2 months ago, it was valued at only $169 billion, easily trumping Facebook's $104 billion valuation at its IPO. That float also gave Alibaba a bigger market capitalization than Amazon, Walt Disney, and Citigroup.
One wonders what goes into all of that. In fact, a lot of people are trying to find out what went into all of that. The Japanese manufacturer Takata is the latest company to be caught in a firestorm of controversy over how it allowed a faulty automobile part to be used for years. New York Times said it might be the target, probably will be, of a U.S. congressional probe.
That's business news. We check it every day on VOA Global. This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. Jim Stevenson along with Ira Melman. Ira, we've got the American Cafe. That's your segment coming up. And also David Byrd with Now, who finds a way to track her pets.
Yeah, I mean, we love our pets here in the United States. But if you've been to Great Britain, you have no idea. We pale in comparison. Now, when you combine how they love their pets in Great Britain and laziness, then you're going to hear what happens. And David Byrd will have it for you coming up in just a moment on VOA Global. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Today we welcome Ashley Westerman back into the cafe. Ashley journeyed through the Appalachia region of the United States, reporting for the Voice of America on issues facing the people there not normally covered by mainstream media. Today Ashley reports on Medicaid, the social health care program for low-income U.S. families and individuals. It was recently expanded under the new health care law, the Affordable Care Act. West Virginia is only one of two states in the southern United States that chose to expand Medicaid. Ashley reports state officials hope this is the start of a major change in the way West Virginians view health care.
Karen Williams of Charleston, West Virginia, has a full house. When the retired preschool administrator has time between her husband, three children, a grandson, her mother, who lives up the street, and four pets, she volunteers to help people sign up for health care through the Affordable Care Act. Williams says her family always had good health care, but when her kids got older, the story changed.
My son was a college student, and there were many semesters when he didn't have health care insurance. My daughter was still in college, had not graduated, did not have health care insurance.
Both of Williams's daughters have taken advantage of Medicaid expansion in West Virginia. For 29-year-old Jocelyn, a student who works two part-time jobs, Medicaid offers a peace of mind.
I recently was in a car accident also, and if I didn't have it, it probably would be a totally different story of what the bills would look like and who they would go to and everything.
Brandon Merritt with the West Virginia Center for Budget and Policy says there were an estimated 270,000 uninsured West Virginians before Medicaid expansion went into effect January 1st.
The majority of them are working. They just did not have access to health insurance through an employer and did not qualify for any sort of public assistance program like Medicaid prior to the expansion.
West Virginia has enrolled nearly 154,000 new individuals into their Medicaid program, second in the nation. The Federal Centers on Medicare and Medicaid numbers show almost 509,000 West Virginians have health insurance under one of the two programs. But funding remains an issue. A study commissioned by Governor Earl Tomlin projected Medicaid expansion would cost the state $375 million for the first 6 years after 2020, when the federal government funding for new enrollees drops to 90%. Officials say they are not sure where that money will come from, but Tomlin said the costs would be greater if they did nothing. Department of Health and Human Resources Deputy Director Jeremiah Samples says the state will need to figure out how to keep costs down. Samples also says West Virginians need to see health care in another way, taking advantage of preventative care instead of waiting until a trip to the emergency room forces them to address a health issue.
Unless there's a change in culture and a change in the way people approach managing their health, then the coverage or the health insurance that they have will not really matter.
Although it is too early to see the true effects of Medicaid expansion, Charleston Area Medical Center, the largest hospital system in the state, recently reported their uninsured population has declined from 7% to around 1%. At the Williams House, Karen says this is the perfect opportunity to change health care in West Virginia.
We were always told we were the most obese. We had the highest rates with diabetes, with, you know, the cancer statistics. We can go on and on. But this may be the turning point.
For VOA News, I'm Ashley Westerman.
You can hear Ashley Westerman's reports weekly here in the American Cafe as part of VOA Global and as a podcast from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe.
Hi, everyone. This is David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Do you own a pet? Would you like some help training them or keeping track of them? Well, there's some new devices that might be just what you need. If you own a dog and you want to train it to fetch and then wait quietly, the auto trainer might be just the trick. It fires a ball and then dispenses food when your dog returns the ball to the machine. Kirsten Dillon told Britain's Sky News the auto trainer helps her with her French bulldog, Louis.
So what it's doing is, if you listen, it's telling Louis that food is coming by reaching a certain pitch. So he knows, he's learning that if he waits patiently and quietly, more to the point, food is going to be delivered.
The auto trainer is just one of several devices that can help teach Rover what to do. With life becoming more hectic in our modern world, Kirsten Dillon says so-called pet tech is just what people need.
We're busier and busier, and we're looking for more and more ways to help us out. Of course, there's a huge market for assistance dogs, and it's growing and it's growing. And there are lots of people with physical disabilities that actually need this technology. So it isn't just a case of lazy owners. There are people out there that do need help.
A U.S.-based company, Fitbark, makes an activity monitor to make sure your dog gets enough exercise. It costs about $70. The Petsy Connect by Petzilla even lets owners watch their pets and interact with them from anywhere using a smartphone. That sells for about $170. And if you want to make sure that Rover is healthy, there's even a pet urine testing kit available from Petnostics. That allows owners to analyze their pet's urine and see the results on their smartphone. But is all this tech good for that human-animal bond we all enjoy? Well, Jordan Shelley of Dogs Today magazine told Sky News that the tech helps, but the face-to-snout time is still needed.
But as long as there's some kind of a balance, you know, and they're used as training aids, then it's not a problem. You know, when you take vitamin C tablets, you also continue eating your fruit, yeah? It's the same sort of thing.
The American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals says that in 2012, 62% of American households owned at least one pet. Americans spent more than $54 billion on their pets last year, and that number is expected to go up. From tracking your pets to tracking firearms now, a Silicon Valley startup has come up with a device that will help police departments know when an officer's gun has been fired. The device from Yardarm Technologies lets dispatchers know when an officer's gun goes off. It also tracks the weapon and tells what direction it was fired in. This device uses geolocation to show where officers are, and it can tell the dispatcher if an officer draws a gun. Jim Schaff is Yardarm's marketing vice president.
So we're connecting the firearm to the internet, and from there we can do a lot of things with it.
Schaff told the Associated Press that the device doesn't interfere with officers' performance in any way.
The officer simply inserts it into the back of the firearm, and now it's installed. They don't even know it's there anymore.
The Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Department in California is currently testing the system. Sheriff Phil Wovak says that it will allow his department to see when officers need help.
We're going to be able to see in real time if our officers are in trouble and they're unable to ask for assistance. That's the worst nightmare for any police officer in the field.
The Yardarm device relies on the internet and connects to officers' smartphones using Bluetooth. It can also feed information to crime scene investigators to let them know how a gun was used. So, what do you think? Let us know your thoughts on these stories or anything else you hear on our program by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia, and you can email us at voaasia@voanews.com. That's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Berg.
This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. Jim Stevenson with Ira Melman. Coming up, we've got our music segment, and we're going to go to the world of sports.
That we are. You know, you talk about frequent flyer mileage. The guys on the golf and the tennis tours, although it's probably paid for them, they might not get all the mileage that
they
need.
They rack it up, though.
Yeah. I mean, it's unbelievable. We were talking about Shanghai and golf last week. Now it's in Turkey.
Wow.
We'll tell you about that in just a second. Hold on with us.
Time for sports on VOA Global. Jim Stevenson with Ira Melman. In golf, leg three of the European Tour's four tournament final series takes us to Turkey for the second staging of the Turkish Airlines Open. That's near the Turkish Mediterranean coast. There's no Tiger Woods, and this time Rory McIlroy also sits out, but there are eight members of Paul McGinley's European Ryder Cup winning side taking part. Nick Dye has this preview.
Most believe that McIlroy already has the job done, and deservedly so, after two major victories, a WGC success and the PGA flagship event at Wentworth. Yet such is the money and points on offer in the final series that three players could push the race right to the wire. Ziem was nowhere near until winning the BMW Masters in Shanghai. Donaldson and Garcia have been prominent throughout, and Donaldson certainly looks to draw on finishing second in Antalya last year when Victor Dubuisson claimed his first tour victory. The Frenchman struggled in China last week and has seen his clubs and gear delayed in transit, but he's every bit one of the players to watch in an elite field, including the likes of Henrik Stenson, Lee Westwood and Ian Poulter.
Nick Dye reporting from Turkey.
Checking tennis, Tomas Berdych will play world number one Novak Djokovic on Friday in a bid to qualify for the semifinals at the ATP World Finals tennis finals. He has a 2-16 record against the two-time defending champion, including a 6-love, 6-2 loss in last month's China Open final.
I'm going to try to, you know, maybe 3-4 games. That would be better from the last time. Well, that experience was really experience, you know. And as I said after my first match, it couldn't be worse than that. So let's see if, you know, it's pretty much same scenario for that. It couldn't be pretty much worse than that as well. But, you know, it's always a huge challenge to play number one player in the world.
Not the most confident guy in the world. The 6-seed Berdych improved his chances of reaching the last four for the second time on his fifth appearance in London when he defeated this year's U.S. Open champion Marek Cilic.
Malaysian badminton ace Lee Chong-wei is fearing he will never realize his dream of becoming world and Olympic champion. He was allegedly suspended for failing a drugs test. The world number one is temporarily barred from competition. That's sports on VOA Global.
Well, it's time for our music segment. Along with Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman on VOA Global. Who made the most money in music last year? Well, Forbes has released its annual list of the top-earning women in music. At number one is Beyoncé, about $115 million. Rounding out the top five, Taylor Swift, $64 million, Pink with $52 million, Rihanna with $48 million, and Katy Perry with $40 million. Income from touring, record sales, publishing, merchandise sales, endorsements, other business ventures was used to calculate their earnings. Forbes also collected data from several industry sources and conducted interviews with artists, managers, lawyers, and label executives.
Well, another big female in pop music, of course, is Whitney Houston. The late Whitney Houston's first live album will be released November 10th. Titled Whitney Houston Live, Her Greatest Performances, it's both a CD and DVD set that spans her national network television debut appearance on The Merv Griffin Show from 1983 to her 2009 performance of I Didn't Know My Own Strength on The Oprah Winfrey Show. Here is Whitney Houston's I Didn't Know My Own Strength.
touch with my soul. I had nowhere to turn, I had nowhere to go. Lost sight of my dream, thought it would be the end of me. I thought I'd never make it through. I had no hope to hold on to. I thought I would break. I didn't know my own strength, and I crashed down and I tumbled, but I did not crumble. I got through all the pain. I didn't know my own strength, survived my darkest hour. My faith kept me alive. I picked myself back up, hold my head up high. I was not built to break. I didn't know my own strength. Oh. In my heart, I found the light to light my way out of the dark. Found all that I need here inside of me. Oh, I thought I'd never find my way. I thought I'd never lift that weight. I didn't know my own strength, and I crashed down, and I tumbled, but I did not crumble. I got through all the pain. I didn't know my own strength, survived my darkest hour. My faith kept me alive. I picked myself back up, hold my head up high. I was not built to break. I didn't know my own strength. There were so many times I wondered how I get through the night. So I took all that I could take. Didn't know my own strength, and I crashed down and I tumbled, but I did not crumble. I got through all the pain. Oh, I didn't. I was not built to break. No, no, I got to know my own strength.
Whitney Houston, it's tragic that we lost her at such a young age. Make sure you tune with us tomorrow and tune with us. Ray McDonald will count down the top five singles of the week here on VOA Global from the Voice of America. From Washington, this is VOA Global from the Voice of America. Jim, you know about crowdsourcing, right?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
So crowdsourcing.
Crowdfunding.
Yeah, it's about funding.
Yeah.
If you had money, would you invest in a movie that deals about washing machines falling in love and fighting with a microwave?
I might invest in actual washing machines if I need one. I don't know about a movie.
Yeah, well, it's a love story, a romantic comedy, we are told.
From
Ben Roper's film's newest project called Final Spin. And it's a tale of the love shared by oft-ignored household appliances. Why?
Because they're ignored. Oh, you know, he's bringing attention to a subject that has some light that needs to be shed on it.
Well,
you know, he says about 50% of this movie still needs to be shot.
Yeah, I guess so. If he's waiting for money, I don't know. Do you? don't read this wrong. But should this be a top loader or a front loader?
It's a side loader.
Producers describe the film as a story of a little machine with a big heart and a dream to experience the world after a long life of clothes washing service. And Roper is promising you'll laugh, you'll cry, it will change your life.
Well, I'm laughing at the story anyway. You know, Ira, the team is hoping to raise an additional $13,000 to complete the film. It looks like the washing machines have already been cast, and I guess all they need at this point is some detergent and more money.
Yeah, a love story involving a washing machine.
It's a clean movie.
That's going to wrap things up for us here on VOA Global for this day. Our thanks today. Tracy Carter is our director, our producer. Diane Gao is our executive producer. And Zabir, for most of the day, was with us.